You are listening to Red Lion Readings, which is recorded live at Civic Theatre Tallaght as part of South Dublin Library's Red Lion Book Festival Readers' Day. In the first half of this programme, you will hear Dermot Bulger in conversation with Gerard Donovan. And for the second half, Dermot will introduce a reading by Kevin Barry. We are joining Dermot at the Civic Theatre as he introduces Gerard to the audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, at enormous expense and direct from Plymouth, where he's come from this morning, I want to introduce the novelist Gerard Donovan. And Gerard, do you want to give a quick reading from... Let's talk to you about this book first, because right. This is the only copy of the book in the country, which I managed to wangle from Easton's Wholesale, with Julius Winson. And Gerard began as a poet, with three volumes of poetry, moved to America, had very, very acclaimed novels, and this one particularly, and this is about a man, a quiet man, who lives in a small cottage in the woods, right. And who doesn't, offend anybody and doesn't take offence and leads a quiet life surrounded by books, by his father's books and with his dog. And one day, hunters, hunting in the woods, shoot his dog. And second piece of advice to give the audience is never shoot Gerard Donovan's dog. It just isn't a good thing to do because the actual... But this novel is set very much in... the house where you live or where you did live. I'm not sure where you're living at the moment, Gerard, but this is in Long Island.
Yeah, I live 70 miles... Good afternoon. I live 70 miles from Times Square, but I live in the middle of woods out in eastern Long Island. And I do live in a cabin, and I do have guns, and I do have a dog. And someone did shoot one of our dogs 1 year, and... I took it very personally because I think it's an act of cowardice to shoot any animal or to mistreat any animal. And I imagined what I would do to that person if I caught him, and obviously that meant I would kill him. And I admitted that to myself and was horrified that I would have such a thought. And as I was crossing the street in Manhattan, the whole book came to me, the title character, the tone, the voice, everything. Possibly because it was in part coming from my own instincts. I wasn't inventing anything. I've never killed anyone, let's say that for the record, but...
And was the shock to you to know that within you there was this, and possibly within all of us, there is the possibility that something could stir us to violence?
Yeah, and I think that the... line between what we call normal living and violence is very, very thin. Mm-hmm. And I was in New York just after the hurricane, and where there were lines at the petrol stations, and I had my shotgun in the car with me, mm-hmm. And so did a lot of other people. And this might horrify you, but it was touch and go. Mm-hmm. And another 14, 15, 21 days... anarchy. And this is how fast what we call civilization can unravel when people don't start getting the things that they want and they're in competition with other people for those things.
And you think that in all societies that line is there? I remember, we've never had hurricanes in Ireland as such, and the way that they've had them in America, but I mean, that's just the deep snow in... 20 years ago, the time that Gareth Fitzgerald went on holidays for the weekend on Wisely and left Michael O'Leary in charge of the country, and the whole country closed down. And I remember seeing the Premier Dairies in Finglas, and they couldn't get trucks out, and there were cars just parked on the road, and people literally fighting to get milk. And this was after one day of snow in Ireland, And so this book interests me. It's the tin veneer, a very, very quiet man, and the way in which he's actually...
He's very cultured, he's very educated.
Lonely and feels lonely. He feels his...
I captured... I live in a cabin, and lived in a cabin when I was writing that, and was surrounded by flowers, and I had the dog. And, everything is me except for the shooting. I didn't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. I know who did it. And he knows that I know he did it. But that's enough. And But we sort of came to an understanding silently that that would never happen again. And the book was written in about 6 weeks because the voice was there. It's as if the world slowed down and I suddenly heard a whisper in my ear. And that was the character of Julius Winsome talking to me. Mm. I hadn't written one line of this book, and the character was already talking to me. That's how urgent the book was to be written. I believe in books having a sense of urgency. Shouldn't that be what a book is about? A story? And I think we've lost, to a certain extent, the power of story. And this book helped me bring it. For me, mm-hmm. It was my major breakthrough book. It sold over 200,000 copies. I've been sort of off radar for 3 or 4 years since writing that because I became ill. And I think that this is the first time I've been in public in 3 or 4 mm-hmm. years.
Jude, do you want to give a short reading from Julius so that your voice can be heard in Tala?
So this is from Julius Winsome, and I hope you enjoy it. Okay. I think I heard the shot. It was a cold afternoon at the end of October, and I was in my chair reading by the wood stove in my cabin. In these woods, many men roam with guns, mostly in the stretches away from where people live, and their shots spray like pepper across the sky, especially on the first day of the rifle hunting season, when people from Fort Kent and smaller towns bring long guns in their trucks up this way to hunt deer and bear. But the metal punch that rang across the forest seemed a lot closer, less than a mile off if it's the sound that killed him. But the truth is that I have imagined hearing it so many times since, rewound the tape of those moments so often that I cannot tell anymore the true sound of the rifle from the phantom of my thoughts. That was close, I said, and opened the wood stove and shoved in another log, closing it before the smoke poured out and filled the room. Most of the hunters, even the beginners, kept the open forest, farther west in the North Main Woods and to the Canadian border. But a good rifle carries far, and the distance can be tricky to figure without walls and roads. It still sounded too close. The seasoned hunters knew where I lived and where all the cabins were in the woods, some in the open, some hidden. They knew not to discharge a weapon, that bullets will travel until they hit something. I had a good fire going and my legs were warm, and I finished the short story by Chekhov, where a girl cannot sleep and the baby won't stop crying, and was so caught up in it that I didn't notice my dog was gone. I had let him out a few minutes before, and it was nothing new for him to wander off, so mostly he stayed 100 yards or so from the cabin in a big circle, his territory, the thing he owned. I went to the door and called for him, thinking again that the sound was a bit close to the house. And then I checked again 10 minutes later and still couldn't find my dog. He didn't come in when I called, louder each time, and when I walked to the edge of the woods and whistled, cupped my hands around my mouth and shouted, there was no sign, no brown shape breaking out of the undergrowth toward me, as he always did when summoned. The wind was cold and I closed the door and slid the towel on the floor against it to block the draft. Then I did something I rarely do in the winter months. I checked the clock. It was 4 minutes past 3. November arrives in northern Maine on a cold wind from Canada that knifes unfiltered through the thin forest, drapes snow along the riverbanks and over the slope of hills. It's lonely up here, not just in fall and winter, but all the time. The weather is grey and hard and the spaces are long and hard, and that north wind blows through every space unmercifully, rattling the syllables out of your sentences sometimes. I grew up in these woods, the forest land at the western edges of the St. John Valley that borders the Canadian province of New Brunswick and runs along the banks and south of the St. John River with its rolling hills and small back settlement towns. My grandfather was French Acadian,
as was my mother. And for reasons unknown to me, he built a cabin miles away from the French, on tree-covered land close to where the great woods began, in the western part of the valley. At the time, it was even more remote than now, and strange because those people stuck together. Most who lived in those settlement towns were descended from the French Acadians expelled by the British from Nova Scotia in 1755. Some went south to Louisiana. The rest moved eventually to northern Maine. These people of extremes, my father said, people of far south and north. It was strange also because of the winters. He built the cabin on 2 acres of cleared land, with the woods on all sides, and my father added a large barn, bigger than the cabin, where he kept all his tools in the truck and anything fragile or easily lost that would not survive the 6 winter months outside. The woods that ringed the house were formed of evergreens and leaf shedders both, pines, oak, spruce, hemlock, maple. And so the trees circling the cabin seemed to step back, retreat in pieces as the leaves turned yellow and deep rust, shredding off like dead skin as September came, crinkling yellow along the floor of the woods as October arrived, and blowing away into November. The cabin came from my mother's French side, my father being English, and I inherited it through her by way of him. He told me that I wouldn't believe it if I saw it, that the valley was like the rolling Midlands of England, but the tongue that echoed in these hills was French, not English. And that was another strange decision, an Acadian woman marrying English. But she was her own woman, I am told. And anyway, they are not people you tell what to do. The cabin blends into the woods, or the woods into the cabin. One moment you were in forest, stepping over a branch, the next puts you walking across a porch, and you want to be careful. Many men live in these woods who cannot live anywhere else. They live alone and are tuned close to any offense you might give them. Best to keep your manners about you, and even better to have nothing to say at all. They came up north and wait out life, or they were here anyway and stayed for the same reason. Such men live at the end of all the long lanes in the world, and in reaching a place like this, they have run out of country they can't live in. They have no choice but to build, and so they go as far out of the way as they can, even here in the deep shade of the trees. I lived far from the nearest of them, the closest cabins 3 miles to the west and north of me. In summer, I kept a bed of flowers along the edge of the clearing, about 30 feet by 3, filled with nasturtiums, marigolds, lilies, and foxglove. And every year I added to the small lawn with sown grass that grew to a hot green carpet in the summer, where I could lie down and smell the flowers and taste the blue sky. But this winter had come late. We had a strange, warm south wind for most of October, and some of the flowers were still alive with their smell, way past season. I'd covered them with black plastic bags, pulled out to little tents on poles to keep them alive through the odd night frost, hoping to keep their color another week and shorten the gray months ahead. They had made my life bright in summer, and I wanted to help them. But in the last couple of days, the temperatures had fallen, and soon these survivors would retreat too, find the safety of the soil and sleep in their seed under the vice grips of deep winter. Except for my dog, I lived on my own, for I had never married, though I think I came near once. And so even the silences here were mine. It was a place built around silences. My father was a reader of books. And spreading along the walls from the wood stove stretched the long bookcases from the living room and on to the kitchen, at the back and right and left of both bedrooms, 4 shelves high, holding every book he ever owned or read, which was the same thing. For my father did indeed read everything. I was surrounded, therefore, by 3,282 books. Leather-bound first editions, paperbacks, all in good condition, arranged by alphabet and recorded on lists written in fountain pen. And because the bookcase ringed the entire cabin, and since some rooms were darker and colder than others, being distant from the wood stove, there were also warm novels and cold novels. Many of the cold novels had authors whose last names began with the letters J and before M. So writers like Johnson and Joyce, Mallory and Owen lived back near the bedrooms. My father called it an outpost of Alexandria in Maine after the Greek library. And he liked nothing better when he came in after work than to stretch his socks to the fire until they steamed, and in his thick sweater and smoking his pipe, then turn to me and ask for a particular book. And I remembered the cold pages in my hands, carrying to my father the volume he wanted, watching it warm under his eyes by the fire. And when he was finished, I carried the warm book back to the shelf and slid it in, a tighter fit because it had grown slightly in the heat. Although he was gone for 20 years, I had the novels and travel books, plays and short stories, all as he had left them, everything he was and knew, still around me. In the afternoon of that Monday, I took one of those books to read, some Russian stories, and when I finished the story, I strained to look out the window. Still, no dog. The clock again, 20 minutes past three. I walked into the clearing and shouted, Hobbs. Thank you.
It's a huge pleasure and an honour to be reunited with Gerard. And best of luck to you, Gerard. Thank you. Kevin Barry has been an irresistible force since he burst upon Irish writing with this wonderful short stories, There Are Little Kingdoms, magnificent novels, and this wonderful new collection of short stories, Dark Lies the Island. He has, he's one of the most sought-after readers in the country. He's a special addition to our bill as a special prize, and it is a huge privilege to introduce one of my favourite readers, Kevin Barry.
Now, a very, very, very short story just to finish. And this is on a more tender note, I think. And it, I think it describes a situation that all of the girls and all of the boys in the audience will be familiar with from some point or other in their lives. Set down in Cork City, this is a story called Across the Rooftops. Early one summer morning, I sat with her among the rooftops of the city, and the fat white clouds moved slowly above us. It was so early as to be a city lost in sleep, and she was really very near to me. My want for her was intense and long-standing, 3 months at least, an eternity. And I was close enough to see the opaque down of her bare arms, each strand curling like a comma at its tip, and the tiny, scratched flecks of dark against the hazel of her eyes. She was just a stretch and a clasp away. The city beneath was lost to the peaceful, empty moments of 5 a.m. It might be a perfect Saturday of July. All I had to do was make the move. Nor was it my imagination that her shoulder inclined just slightly towards me. There was a dip in the way she held the shoulder bare also beneath the strap of her vest top. The shoulder's dip must signal an opening. "No, I don't want to sound painfully cool here," I said. "I believe you," she said. "But you may be looking at the man who brought Detroit techno to the savages of Cork City," I said. We talked about the music and the clothes and the hours we had spent together, the nightclub, and then the party at the flat that was rented by friends, all of whom were panned out inside now, asleep or halfway there. And we had climbed onto the rooftop to see the day come true. Every line had the dry, inflected drag of irony. Feeling was unmentionable. We talked about everything except the space between us. I sat on my hands. I thought about maybe kissing her shoulder. How would that be for a move? Be the work of 2 seconds, a lean-to, a planting of the lips, a withdrawal, and a shy little glance to follow. "I should maybe think about going," she said. "I really needed to make the move." "Don't yet," I said. The pool of silence that was the city beneath us, was broken but infrequently. A scratch of car noise from a cab rank, the tiny bark of a dog from high in the estate somewhere, very distant, the sound of the traffic lights turning on the corner of Washington Street and Grand Parade. Across the way, the church in its steeple, the grey of old devotion, the greened brass of its dome. I turned towards her, and I looked at her directly, and her eyes braved me to make the move. "So any plans for Saturday?" I said. I read again the disappointment in her. She was urging me on, but onwards I could not make ground. "It depends," she said. Her shoulder dipped a fraction again. Now was the moment. I sat on my hands, and I looked out across the rooftops and saw nothing, registered nothing but the hard, quickening beat of my heart. "So, how's it you know Cecile again?" I said. She sighed and explained the connection. It was through the university. They had shared a place on French's Quay as first years. "And how do you know Cecile?" She said it in an exaggeratedly bored way, an automated drone, the words running into each other, a mockery of me. The flat, high up on Washington Street, was Cecile's. Cecile had, in her bedroom, loudly been screwing some boy for most of the night. Cecile had no trouble ever making the moves. "Cecile's had a good night anyway," I said. "Yeah," she said. "Maybe I should just ask," I thought. "Can I kiss you? How would that sound?" A gull descended to the lip of the church's roof. Across the breadth of the street, the mad stare of its eye was vivid and comical and a taunt to me. I allowed my left hand to emerge from beneath my buttock, and I let it travel the space between us along the cool stone of the roof's ledge, and I placed my fingers lightly on hers. No response. I listened for a change in her breathing. Nothing. She was still even and steady, and I turned to look at her, and blithely still she looked out and across the rooftops. She did not incline her head towards me, and she did not speak at all. I drew back my fingers, but only by an inch or two. I looked to see if she would withdraw her hand to a safer distance, but she did not. She breathed evenly. Hard rasps of jungle panic ripped up my chest inside. I thought, what's the worst that can happen here? The worst that can happen is I lurch and she recoils. It'd be so much worse not to try. "So all I have to do now," I said, "is make the move." "Oh, Jesus Christ," she said. "What? You're killing this stone dead," she said. But she did not get up from the ledge. She did not leave my side. She allowed the silence to swell and fill out again. Now birdsong taunted from the direction of Bishop Lucy Park. What if I left it to her to make the move? Procreation would end and the world would stop spinning. The birdsong rose up now and strung its notes along the rooftops and linked them in a jagged line. The rise and fall of the steeples and chimneys was as though a musical notation. There was dead quiet from the flat inside. The last awake, we had the morning to ourselves. "I really like you," I said. "Okay," she said. "I mean really, really." Very hard to put the words out, but they were on the air and at their work now. I turned to look at her, and she turned but to look away. I saw that a flush had risen to her cheek, the perfect knit of her collarbone as it turned, and flawless brown from a good June, the smooth curve of her shoulder, like rounded stone made smooth by water. It was as if my words had just flown up into the white sky above and imploded there, as if an answer was not needed. "Okay," I said. This meant everything. All of summer would be coloured by this. She did not seem to breathe then. I kept my eyes fixed on her, and she looked anywhere but at me, and I counted the seconds away as she did not turn to face me. In my evil dreams, I had seen myself approach her with lascivious intent, with a cold, thin, cruel, sexual mouth just parted slight ways, and I went deep then to find a way to make this suave magic come real. Still, something in her presence unmanned me. Perhaps it was the sense I was aiming too high. She was really very beautiful. "Turn to me," I said. She laughed, but only a tiny laugh, and was shock in it. I was forceful now out of nowhere, and she turned to me. I leaned in without pause. I did not allow the words to jumble up in my head and forbid me, and I placed my lips on hers. She responded well enough. The opening of the lips was made. Our jawbones worked slowly and devoutly, but we did not ascend to the heavens. The kiss did not take. And after I don't know how long, maybe half a minute, maybe a bit more, she placed very lightly on my chest the tips of her fingers, and the tiny pressure she applied there told me it was over already. The pressure was of a fuse that fed directly from her heart. Gently so at her fingertips, she pushed me back to break the kiss. She turned quickly to look away. I turned as quickly to look in the opposite direction. My heart opened and took in every black poison the morning could offer. Midsummer. Slant of the sun coming through the white clouded sky then. And the church across the way drew its own shade over half of Washington Street. A fat pigeon flew beneath the eave of the church, and only the heavy beat of its wings on the air broke the dark spell that had formed about us. I turned to look at her, and she responded with a half smile, half sorrowful. She placed her palms face down on the ledge and pushed herself to a stand, languid for a movement, to let me know what I was missing. "I'm going to go," she said. I nodded as coolly as I could. That I could muster even the tiniest measure of cool was credit to my resilience. I was resilient as the small medieval city beneath throw a siege upon me, and I will withstand it. She crawled through the Velux window to the flat inside, and I heard after a few moments the turn and click on the flat's door, then her footsteps on the stair. With her steps fading, the summer went, even as the sun came higher across the rooftops and warmed the stone ledge and the slates, and I looked out across the still, quiet city, and I sat there for hours and for months and for years. I sat there until all that had been about us had faded again to nothing, until the sound of the crowd died. And the music had ended, and we all trailed home along the sleeping streets with youth packed away and life about to begin. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Good man. Thank you. Oh.
My nerves aren't better for that. I've never had a kiss in Cork have the tension of the Cuban Missile Crisis before. Kevin Barry will be signing copies of his book and giving advice on the sexual uses of tiramisu at the next interval. It's a huge pleasure to have him here.
You've been listening to The Red Line Readings, a Curious broadcast production in partnership with South Dublin Libraries. Red Line Readings was part of South Dublin Libraries' Red Line Book Festival and was curated by writer Dermot Bulger. You can podcast this programme on southdublinlibraries.com and on curiousbroadcast.com. Red Line Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a broadcasting authority of Ireland fund.